Welcome to this class this morning. I'd like to think of two Bible examples very briefly. One is the Apostle Paul's multiple languages. Did he learn that by rote or by critical thinking? Obviously by rote. And then one day, his nephew brought him a very urgent message about some enemies and their plot. Now, did that nephew make his decisions and find the Apostle Paul by rote learning or by critical thinking? Well, very obviously by critical thinking, because rote learning can't memorize that many answers. Let's talk about this. What is rote learning? A simple way to explain rote learning is it's a memorized solution to a memorized problem or question. For example, we have the multiplication tables. What's 6 times 6? 36. That's right. Or we have other memorized lists. The list of Canadian prime ministers. We could learn that list by rote memory. We have the provincial capitals. We associate them with provinces. Memorized. We have the four laws of universal gravitation. They're just four laws. They're statements, etc. There are many, many things that we know because we have learned them by rote. Now, rote can be useful when quick learning is required, such as that telephone number that you need. You just learn it by rote really quickly, and you have it as long as you need it, and then it goes again. Or following directions to a place. You stand there and you listen or take notes, and you get it, quick memory work, and you go to the place. Rote learning can give the impression of understanding something while not really comprehending the subject matter. It seems he's wise because he just spins off these answers, but he might not really understand the subject. For example, he could rattle off the four laws of universal gravitation and really not know much at all about gravity. In fact, you could with some effort get a grade four student to memorize those four laws. But he would know very little about their depth and what gravity really is about. Let's talk about critical thinking now. What is critical thinking? Critical thinking is a process of reasoning and analysis that uses factual information and comes to logical conclusions. We use critical thinking to solve practical problems, problems that don't have memorized solutions. Now here's the other side. A critical thinker can appear to understand something but may be very wrong in his conclusions. Maybe he didn't have enough rote. For example, he could use very rich and scientific language to describe how your house is not gravitationally attracted to the CN Tower in Toronto. But he's wrong, because he's missing one of the very foundational laws of universal gravitation. But he sounds so knowledgeable and he explains the process, but he's still wrong. Because one of the laws of universal gravitation says that every material object in the universe is attracted to every other material object. Here's a question. Which is better, rote learning or critical thinking? Could have an answer. A mix of both, he said. Good answers. That's where I wanted you to be. The answer is that neither is better. We can't answer it that way. And that's one of our problems. We get hung up on trying to answer a question that can't be answered. So let's stop trying to decide which is better. It's more, maybe more a matter of where we use them. The truth is that both are necessary. We need both. We could think of it this way. Look at me. Are you looking at me? Rote learning alone has a brain full of facts and no place to use the facts. What did I say? You're just about right. With no place to use. That's good. You almost learned that by rote. But let's look at the other side. Critical thinking alone has analyzing power with nothing to analyze. Have to digest that for a little bit. So what we're saying again and again is that the one without the other is lame. We're going to have both to be effective. And as we go through this talk, I want to try to be balanced. We want our students to move toward critical thinking. We're agreed on that. But we also want to avoid the modern push that says that it's critical thinking we want. We don't need rote learning anymore. We don't need all those. I'll talk about that a bit more. But in studying for this talk, it was difficult to just look at the one or the other because there's so much crossover. They are intricately intertwined with each other. Well, let's look at some of these ideas a bit further. Rote learning frees up working memory. I'll give you an example. Would that work? Is that how you teach? You wouldn't set it up that way. Okay. Are there any other ways we could try? We could write it every way. We could write it this way. With enough critical thinking, you could probably do math that way too, couldn't you? Okay. If we write it like this, we feel a lot more at home with the process. We know exactly where we're going, what we're doing, looks normal. Okay, so what are we gonna do with 4 times 5? You didn't memorize that. Your teacher never taught you what 4 times 5 is. What are you gonna do?
Count your fingers.
Okay, you count your fingers. Right? Then we could put that there and then guess what to do next. How many wrong ways are there to do? Sometimes teachers actually ask that. There are a lot of wrong ways to do something. Now, but all of this is designed to help us think. All of those processes are controlled because of rote learning. If I'd have asked you to multiply those two numbers, you'd have written it down on your paper in neat orderly form, you'd have gotten started, and never even thought about the process. You'd have just multiplied. Because rote learning, memorized solutions, has taken care of all that clutter. That's just one example. It frees the brain to focus the remaining energy on the things that rote learning can hardly do. A memorized answer to all three-digit multiplicands and three-digit multipliers. Would you like to try that with rote learning? 829 times 562. You know, you got that memorized, you got to start on 830 times. Rote learning is powerful, but it's limited. Isn't it? Let's both. What about this? What are we finding?
Volume of a cylinder.
Volume of a cylinder. It's good. What's this stand for?
Volume.
Pi.
Radius.
Height. What's the value of pi?
3.14.
Rounded. You can carry it further if you like. That's right. What's rote learning have to do with that? Well, you knew all those things. You knew that was volume, pi, you knew what the value was, you knew radius, you knew height. All of those things, memorized solutions, helps us. We didn't have to start studying and researching and finding out that this is a Greek letter and then whatever that means, why you use Greek in math, and then eventually learn that it's a decimal, or maybe even figure it out ourselves, go to your silo at home and measure around it, and then measure across and divide and see what you get, and then go to this thing and measure around that and try it again, and then to your thermos and so on. They eventually figure out what pi is. Rote learning takes care of it all. You know what pi is, and you know what it does in here. But does one more thing. It helps us to take this formula a step further. And so, well, now I get the two tangled together again. I'm in trouble again, like I was saying. So rote learning has this understood, the V and the pi and the R and the H. But critical thinking then enters the picture and says, I wonder if I knew that I wanted 1,000 gallons of water and had a 2-foot well casing, I wonder how deep it would have to go into the ground in order to make 1,000 gallons. Is that calculable with this formula? Yes, we're simply solving for
H.
We take the same formula and we solve it for H and we figure out, of course you better remember to change your 1,000 gallons to cubic feet or something, or you're gonna have trouble. That's critical thinking again. But we solve this thing for H, we put our B formula in there, pi is given, we set 2 foot diameter, 1 foot radius, and away we go. Back to our multiplication problem. If we relied entirely on rote learning, we would need to memorize the answer for every multiplication problem under the sun. We talked about that briefly. That would be impossible. Can't do that. Critical thinking allows us to take the concepts from one problem and apply it to the next. In the volume formula, okay, we covered that. We can solve for R or for H. All right, story time. India. My wife and I lived in India for a few years. And we made some observations there. One of the observations that we learned is that a lot of education in India is by rote, which obviously is good in many ways, but it has its limitations. So they learn a lot of memorized solutions to memorized problems. The difficulty is that when they face in real life a problem that's not memorized, they therefore don't have a memorized solution. They're stuck on things that they shouldn't be stuck on. That's where critical thinking becomes powerful for us. We take the concepts and learn to apply them. For example, one day, where we're studying Hindi language is up on the foothills of the Himalayan mountains. How do I describe? Very mountainous. The switchbacks are intense up those mountains and up to our place where we live. One day the taxi, we walked often, but we had a taxi that was taking us down those switchbacks, and they don't always keep them in the best of shape, and there was a hole in the road big enough to bury a calf. And the front wheel of the taxi landed in the hole. We're stuck. We're done. And so we get out, and Brother John Beringer, whom some of you know, all of you know, and some better than others, and I were there, and these natives, didn't know much Hindi yet, but they were going on trying to figure out how to solve this problem. And of course, problems are exciting. In India, more people gather makes it better, right? So we get more and more people together and try to figure out what to do with the taxi that's stuck. And Brother John, with signs and wonders, didn't waste a lot of time, and he said, driver, in. And men, around this taxi. We just gathered around there. We just lifted the car out of the hole. Men can't lift a car. But maybe men could. But there was no textbook that taught them that. You understand that inhibiting force of only rote learning. They didn't think beyond. I'm not being hard on them or their culture or anything, but it was a real lesson to me. It seemed they didn't act too amazed, but I think they were marveling that such a thing could be. That it was that simple, to simply lift that car out with manpower and we're back on the road again. Another example, in India, one time on one of those intensive switchbacks between our house and the city of town of Missouri, we were standing there, my wife and I, looking down on a walk or something, and we met one of our language teachers there. And I asked him, out of interest, I want to know the answer, how far it is from language school, close to where we live, to the city of Missouri. How many feet of elevation? And he almost said what he should have said. But it's hard, very hard, for a native Indian to say, I don't know. He should have said that. He almost, then he said, about 150 feet. Well, one or two switchbacks would have given us 150 feet. I mean, at least we knew he was wrong. We didn't try to believe it. I learned later it was 1,000 feet of elevation. But I think the same thing was happening there. He didn't have the power of logic like he should have. Logic should have told him that distance right there, you know how logic works. The neighbor's silo is 60 feet high, or the barn's 30 or whatever. We kind of develop what I call them with my students, fuzzy logic. And I teach them fuzzy logic. Do you too? I ask them, how big do you think this is? And they have to guess, and then we measure it. And how tall? Heights especially, they'll get wrong. They think all the cows are 5 feet tall. Well, maybe you do too. You could measure your cows at home and see how many are 5 feet tall. And so we tend to get it wrong with heights especially, height and depth. But develop that fuzzy logic, that's what we're doing. We're helping to avoid that snare of just rote learning. We were studying Hindi language. And we're getting heavy into the verbs and so on. And you know verbs, how they work, they're fascinating. I, of course, came from a reference of knowing these verbs and their principal parts. I see, I saw, I will see, I have seen, I shall have seen. Fascinating. Six beautiful tenses. And there they are in our books, right? You can see it in your English textbooks. Charts. There are no charts that I could find. Our teacher was a gifted teacher. He'd come to class and he'd say, so where are you? They had a lot of different people working through their school there. So where are you? And I'd say, lesson 16. Oh, let's see, lesson 16 is about, he never opened this book. He knew what lesson 16, and he just teaching. Good teacher. But I asked him one day, I said, don't you have charts? So I could see these verbs. And there are a few verbs that are a little uncanny. Does English have any of them? Anyhow, I asked him if he didn't have charts. So I wanted to see this thing. Oh, why not? You just learn by rote, that's why. Just memorize it. You just see. You just learn, this is the way you talk. Well, and that's good. We learn by rote too. That's how our mothers taught us English. That's good. But sometimes it helps to see it in a chart. What I did then is I went and made my own charts. My ah, my aya, my ai, my aunga, and so on. I made my own charts. Which, what do you think it did? It taught me Hindi. If you have to make your own chart, you're going to have to learn, you have to study. That was good for me. But I took it to him later and showed him my charts. I think he was mildly impressed. I don't think charts meant much to him. That's not how you learn. You just learn by rote. You just memorize. Okay. Now you say, well, you're being kind of hard on rote, right? Yeah, right now I am. That's right. But like we said at the beginning, we have to have them both. I want to talk about a few dangers of the modern view right now before I go on. And I'm not mitigating the value of critical thinking by doing this, but there's a lot of pressure around today that would look negatively at rote learning. And we want to view critical thinking with high esteem. And that has its place. But one of the downfalls is that learning should be very little lecture and almost entirely interactive. Now again, I'm in favor of interactive learning. I'm doing some of that right now. I'm making you talk to me occasionally. But it's only partly right. It pampers the concept that I don't need anyone telling me what to do. I can figure it out myself. What if you had to figure it all out yourself? How long would you have to live to get very far in life? We don't want to go there. The other serious error is that there are no absolutes. We don't have absolutes. We can't learn anything by rote. Because 6 times 6, it's... We would say absolutely, they're absolute. 6 times 6 is always 36. We need to be careful in our schools that we don't foster that type of thought process. So there are no absolutes. There are absolutes. Right here are the best ones. But even beyond that, the four laws of universal gravitation I talked about, those are absolutes. And so everything is open for discussion. It's open for debate. Everything needs to be proven to be believable. Really? Dr. Wilson was talking to a group of, I'm not sure where they were in the education scheme of things, but let's say they were 17 and 18 year olds. In school, college, he was talking to a group of them. And he was telling them a story about how Lazarus came out of the tomb. Jesus called into that tomb. Lazarus, come forth! And he came out. And he told that story. And a while later, one of those young men sitting up front came to him and he said, Dr. Wilson, he said, I don't believe anything I can't see. He said, I don't believe that Lazarus came out of the tomb. He said, that doesn't make sense. It's not scientific. I don't believe anything I can't see. Dr. Wilson said, oh. So he said, how does a butterfly get out of its cocoon? Oh, the man said, the young man, he said, it chews its way out. Oh, Dr. Wilson said, you look really wise. How many teeth? So he pressed him again. He said, how does a butterfly get out of its cocoon? Oh, he said, it produces some kind of chemical that dissolves the cocoon. And Dr. Wilson said, you look very wise. He said, what kind of chemical would dissolve the cocoon and not dissolve that delicate butterfly? Oh, he didn't know. Eventually he walked away, gave up. A little bit later, Dr. Wilson's little daughter came out on the porch. She had been inside the door listening. And she said, like little people, you know, she said, Dad, how does a butterfly know it's going to come out? And you know what he said? He said, I have no idea. He said what that Indian man should have said and didn't. And that makes our God bigger. And us smaller. We don't have to have an answer for everything to behold the wonder of it. I was hoping too when I heard that story to find out what Dr. Wilson, he didn't know either. We don't have to know. And so we want to foster that in our schools, that concept. Not that we don't know things, we do want to know things, but that not everything is just open for analytical dissecting. There are things we accept by faith, like the story of Lazarus. We don't have to put together how he came back from the dead. We couldn't if we tried. Don't need to. Well, let's talk about how to effectively teach both rote learning and critical thinking. First of all, rote learning. This happens intensively in the younger grades. We might illustrate this way. Just a very quick illustration. Rote learning would probably go a little like this. And critical thinking would probably go a little like this. Now I realize that's very brief and simple, but what we're saying is that when a child is young, most of what he learns is by rote. There's very little critical thinking going on. He's learning heavily by rote, but as he gets older, the amount of rote learning is dropping, and the amount of critical thinking, hopefully, is on the rise. He's starting to put things together and say, well, if that works, then that's just what you want from your students. He's thinking for himself. He's putting together information. But in the younger grades, we're talking about rote learning. We have letters. I know my ABCs. Is that good enough? Know his ABCs. He maybe should learn the sounds of them yet. See, in Hindi, that's easier because when you know the 50 letters of the Hindi alphabet, you know the sounds they make because the name of the letter is the sound, always. That makes it easier. He even has to know how to put letters together. His ba, be, bi, ba, ba, sometimes we say. He has to know that. He has to know math facts. How many? A lot. It takes a lot of work. Remember this, first and second grade teachers, that if you want to do something that will change the world and get no credit for it, then teach a child to read. How many teach first grade? I'm really curious. Oh, good. So fascinating. I better put my hand down. I never taught first grade. I didn't know how. But I fully believe that. Well, think of what you do when you open those little eyes to the world of reading. I've thanked my grade one teacher more than once for what she taught me. You should too if you didn't yet. It's hard work. You teachers know it's hard work, but it's rewarding. And so, what is the method? I want you to remember this. Rote teachers, teachers teaching by rote, to give answers. What did I say? Give answers. That's what I want to remember. Give answers. Sometimes teachers get caught and they think that that the answers are supposed to come back on test time. How will the answers come back on test time if you don't give them to them? That's an important concept. Do mothers give answers? I know mothers spend a lot of time looking through the book. What's that? But who told him? We give answers. All day long we give answers. And then every once in a while we pull the answers away and we hand them a test. That's what we call it. Grade one doesn't have lots of tests, probably. That's good. In the older grades. And we see if they got what we told them. I've heard of a younger room teacher one time that didn't think she should put the math facts, 1 + 1 and 1 + 2, on the chalkboard with the answers under them because she was giving answers. No, that's your job, is to give answers. It's kind of hard to learn without answers, isn't it? I could tell you the story of the father and son walking together. You know that story? And the father asked, what makes lightning? And the son asked, what makes lightning? And the father said, I have no idea. And then the boy asked, what makes a tornado happen? And he said, I have no idea. I'm talking fast right now. And then the boy tried once more a little while later. He asked, what makes the leaves come off the trees and fall? And the father said, I have no idea. And then the little boy said, okay, I'll stop asking questions then. And the father said, no, keep asking questions, that's how you learn. Okay, you see where we're going with this. Unless you give answers, there's no learning happening. So, answers first. We put maps on top of their desks, don't we, sometimes? Hang them on the walls. We put answers all over the place. And we talk about those answers and drill them. And then we ask them, yeah, we need to get them back too. Drill is my next point. Can't be overemphasized. You know what the Negro said? When he was asked about being... I forget if it was an effective teacher or preacher. I can't remember which it was. And he said, first I tell him what I was going to tell him. Then I tells him. And then I tells him what I told him. That sounds like teaching. And teachers, we have to love to do that. I do.
That's a teacher's life. We just love to say it again and say it again. And open the eyes once more and say it again.
Drill, drill, drill. Use variety, but keep drilling. And you know what I'm talking about. You drill sometimes until you think surely they have it, and then you drill some more yet. And finally, review. It's good to have a pattern of review. And I think a lot of this does happen through good textbooks, which we have. We have good textbooks, and we also have good teacher's manuals, which greatly help in that, in guiding us through that review process. It's essential. Even in the upper grades, we know that. We have to keep reviewing. How do we teach critical thinking? What's the method? Well, one is limited lecture. Now I'm talking more to the older grades. Remember the graph. And so I want to be careful that I'm understood there. In the older grades, some lecture is good, but we can over-lecture. It leads to boredom and waning interest in the material. Over-lecturing leads to boredom and waning interest. I heard of students falling asleep in history class, and I cannot connect with that. Not because I'm such a good teacher, but I would say that something was wrong with the presentation. There's the odd time. Maybe he's sick today and he should have stayed home and slept. There are exceptions, I'm sure. But in general, teachers, we need to check ourselves. With older students, you don't need to read grade 7's English lesson to them, or geography lesson for that matter. That's their job. Why did they teach them to read? That's why. Your job at that stage is to hit the main points. Talk about them. Keep it lively and interesting. Discuss the problem areas. Now here's something you're going to have to make sure you catch. And then tell them how it works. You're hitting the problem spots, the tough spots. Your job is to light the fires of interest. Get them enthused about what's here. And then move on. Don't over-lecture. Another is doors to discovery, we're calling it. Now this needs to be guided because not everything I discover is right. I one time saw a machine was being pulled down the highway. We were on a trip. I was a boy. And I told my siblings that that's a machine to lift a downed cow. And my father kindly told me that that's a machine to lower a vault into a grave. I was old enough to be fairly embarrassed by that. So, discovery needs to be guided. But having a student discover truth for himself is effective. Students will come back with happy eyes because they found something that fits with what they're learning. They learned something. God made us to want to know. Don't dampen it. Guide it. That's what we're saying. Don't stomp on it. Put out the fire. Just guide it. Say, well, I think you're right, but are you sure that... Guide his discovery. Critical thinking is taught by excellent questions. Instead of saying, list the 4 laws of universal gravitation, and we need to do that, by the way. We need to have them. But we could say, give an example for each of the 4 laws of universal gravitation. We're teaching critical thinking. We're saying, here's the law, here's how it applies. And be sure to ask questions about, are you listening? Maps, charts, and graphs. Some books are loaded with excellent maps, charts, and graphs. If you never question about them, you're telling your students that they're kind of there to fill up space. A graph is powerful, but you have to understand it. Now, in teaching a lesson, you might say, now, here's a graph that's really fascinating. And then talk a little bit about it. But then make sure that that learning is stimulated by asking questions about it. Critical thinking is taught by effective discussions, not arguments. Never argue. Remember that an argument is an exchange of ignorance, and a discussion is an exchange of knowledge. That's one reason God never argues. I didn't say the only reason, because he just knows. Whenever you see two boys arguing, either one or both is ignorant. I know it doesn't sound very nice, but it's true. Otherwise, they wouldn't argue. Would two boys argue about what 5 plus 5 is? Probably not, because they both know. So don't argue. But discussions often lead us to analytical thinking. We benefit from the perspectives and perceptions of others. And teachers, we need to learn how to guide discussions and say, that's a good idea. I hadn't thought of that before. You might need to say, yes, I see what you mean, but I'm not sure that's quite right. Could we have another thought? Don't just level over wrong, things that aren't right, but guide the discussion. We can learn so much from discussions. Another is well-rounded curriculum. And I'm going to talk about a few subjects here. One subject that develops critical thinking is algebra, because usually the front door is locked. And so many good thinking processes are learned in finding the back door. I could talk for a long time about that, but I shouldn't. Students that have come through an algebra course, and I'm not saying that a student that doesn't take algebra in school is handicapped for life. You didn't hear me say that. It's not true. But a student that comes through a good algebra course, I don't think they ever quite face life's problems the same way. They don't get quite so flustered. There's probably an answer to this. I've watched it in school already. I watched them calmly think through things instead of right away saying, I can't find it. Well, they're used to that, not finding the answer. I have to look for it. All right. Trigonometry is another. But did you think about it, that if you're going to study trigonometry, you're going to have some rote in there too? All of these. Algebra is the same way. Okay, let's keep going. Composition. This is excellent in developing critical thinking. Teachers, use it. Teach composition. Don't just have composition class. Teach composition. We need more writing today that catches people's interest and holds it to the end. We need it. The church needs it. You can't just read the first few sentences in an article and the last few and pretty well know what's in between. We need to get past that. I'm not faulting anyone. God gives different talents. Understand me, but I'm talking to the people that are influencing the next generation. And we can teach composition effectively. Writing makes an exact man. Why? Because he's forced to analyze. You're not going to write it on paper unless you thought it through. At least you shouldn't. What did Benjamin Franklin say? If you would not be forgotten when you are old and dead and rotten, either read something worth writing or write something worth reading. That's what he said. If all of us here, at least those from about age 18 to 38, I would too. I'd gladly join you. If we'd all write a 500-word thesis on the plain coat, would it affect us? Brother Tom, do you think it would affect us?
Yes, it would.
It would even help me. Sure it would. Because it'd make me go back to the basics and say, why do I wear a plain coat if I don't know it's past time to write? Past time. Don't get your 8th grade students to write on the plain coat. Now, I'm not saying that. But that's not where I'm going with this. But composition teaches critical thinking. Get them to think hard. Who wrote A Plea for Fishing? Somebody did. Who wrote Chickens and Wheelbarrows? Somebody did. You can write good parables too, and your students can, but you have to guide them. Literature. Questions that force us to make conclusions that weren't given. That's critical thinking. Good literature courses do that. And students gradually move into that, and they get sort of disturbed sometimes. The book doesn't say. The book doesn't need to say. You need to figure out from what it does say. Art. Art teaches critical thinking. You might say, wait, no, it does. But it has to be taught again. Art must be taught. And good art classes help us to perceive more than the obvious. We're looking beyond the picture. Art teachers teach their students that we draw things not as they are, but as they, can you finish it? Appear to be. That's right. Not as they are, but as they appear to be. And sometimes a student will look at a picture, or a teacher for that matter, and chuckle a little and say, whoever drew that foot didn't quite know where he was going. That's the easy part. You know what the hard part is? To decide what's wrong with that foot. Or maybe harder yet is to draw one that looks right. You take the challenge then. And don't be hard on your students when they say things like that. Don't be hard on them, because that means that they're thinking critically. They're saying that I don't. That's not right. That's not how people's feet are. That's good. But then you must take them one step further. You all just have a chuckle about it. What good? What did we learn? That 6 times 6 isn't 35, I guess. But we have to know what it is then. And so take the challenge and show them what's wrong with that foot. Here's how it should be. Or maybe it's a building perspective. Whatever it is. Pardon me. And finally, the excellence of experience. Not everything needs to be learned by the hot stove method. We learn from others. And teachers, that's your job. Pass on what you've learned and keep on teaching. Now, I just wrote down here a few things that we have a few minutes yet. Till 12 o'clock, isn't that right? Is that what the program says? Some interest, things that spark critical thinking. I just wrote a few down. What happens? Darren, we're going to put you in the back of my pickup. You're going to have a baseball. I'm going to drive down the road at 80 kilometers an hour this way. And you're going to throw the ball off the back of the pickup this way. 80 kilometers an hour, what will happen to that ball relative to the ground? You're thinking, I don't know what I mean by that.
The ball of the chalk hill will still be in the same trajectory.
It'll still be in the same trajectory, he said. Okay. There's a discussion going on. I'm not going to influence the discussion too much at this point yet. I will shorten it.
Don't you have to throw it at the same speed as what you're driving?
He means to throw at the same speed as I'm driving, yes. In the opposite direction. What will happen to the ball? Boys love this kind of discussion. See, and girls listen to it quite well. It what?
It would drop straight down.
It would drop straight down. That's what you're thinking too. It would roll a wee bit. He thinks so. But Arnold, what would happen? What would happen to the ball?
It would drop straight down. We've done it.
But Arnold and I have a little comradeship in this, because we were believing that, I don't know if we should do this. We did it at a teacher meeting one time. I was the boy in the back of the truck. And he was the careful driver. And the first time, we didn't get the speeds matched very well. The next time, we got it just right. And the whole group of students, teachers, was standing there watching, and literally the ball simply dropped straight down. That's right. I suppose it rolled. Most balls roll and hit the ground, but it didn't follow the truck or go away. Now, if you're asking some questions in your mind, yeah, that's good.
that's what critical thinking does. It says, but why? Did you ever think it would? That if a fighter jet, we don't fight. But fighter jets, they're balls. If a fighter jet's flying at 2,000 miles per hour and shoots a bullet up the front, that bullet is traveling relative to ground. What now, since you were listening so well? He threw the bullet 2,000 miles per hour over the nose of that jet. He was flying at 2,000. How fast is that bullet going?
4,000
miles per hour. Now he's flying at 2,000 miles per hour, and he shoots the bullet out the back. What's happening to the bullet now? It would fall straight down. And then the students will say, but it wouldn't even hurt the jet behind me. Listen, does it matter whether the bullet drives into you at 2,000 or whether you drive into the bullet at 2,000? Does that make any difference? Those are good questions that stimulate thoughts. And those boys will keep talking about that at lunchtime a little bit. That's good. But it's nice to know what the answers are, but sometimes teachers don't. Don't be embarrassed always about that either. Sometimes teachers have to say, well, I'd like to find out. And I'm not saying you should necessarily do that. I mean, you have to be careful with experiments like this, that if you do them, Brother Arnold and I talked about that day, that if I'd get a broken leg or something from our experiment, how we would answer for that. So we need to think about those things. But it was an experiment that settled in our minds what we expected to happen. Or you could ask this question. You have a pickup and trailer. The trailer is full of chickens. You drive onto the scales, and it weighs 8,500 kilograms. And then you scare those chickens really badly, and they all fly. Will the scales change? Maybe we'll have to finish that at lunchtime. Lord bless you.